Okay, so it's a pleasure to be here and to be part of this nuclear physics program as a visitor from particle theory. The notion of electric vacuum stability was posted on the advertisement of this workshop, so I thought it is maybe appropriate for me to present a talk on this topic since we have been working on this recently. And so I think I will be presenting the most precise determination of the electric vacuum stability analysis, and also with emphasis on the gauge independence of the results, as you will see in the talk. So the results presented here were obtained in collaboration with these people here. Our most recent paper is with Pikelner and Veretin, and also Rednyakov. So this is the outline of my talk. Since this is a non-particle physics community, I thought it may be appropriate if I also flash you know, the facts about the discovery of the Higgs boson in a short paragraph. This is the center part, and I also have an outlook on cosmological implications of these results. So the discovery of a weak neutral resonance, which shares the properties of the Higgs boson of the standard model in terms of the discrete quantum numbers and also the coupling strengths, has greatly consolidated the standard model of particle physics. And as you will see here, the masses of the standard model particles happen to be such that there are good chances for the standard model to be valid all the way up through the Planck mass scale. So this discovery has not only completed the particle content, the particle multiplet of the standard model by adding for the first time an elementary scalar particle. It has also somehow, it's more than a discovery of a particle, it's really establishment of the generation of mass for the fundamental particles via the electroweak, the breaking of the electroweak symmetry via the Higgs mechanism. So I don't have to go into this. This is all textbook knowledge. But I need to talk on the Higgs potential because it's one of the main ingredients of our analysis. So as you all know, in the standard model, we have a Higgs Lagrangian that looks like this, and the potential has a mass term and a quartic coupling. And there are two phases depending on the sign of this mass parameter. And the transition from somehow the unbroken phase to the broken phase can be envisaged as some cosmological phenomenon. And so in fact, after the symmetry breaking and the Higgs mechanism, this is done in the unitary gauge. This, we have an excitation, a radial excitation here in this Mexican head potential. And if you somehow put this on the mathematical side, you get a relationship between this mass parameter and the actual mass term of the Higgs boson, this relationship. And if you also inject the relationship between the masses of the gauge bosons, in particular W boson, you can actually evaluate the vacuum expectation value with this number. Of course, I should say this is all done for bare fields and bare parameters, and the renormalization of this potential and other terms of the standard model will be discussed later in this talk. Okay, so important here is that via this relationship, the linear Higgs term is eliminated, and this is important also later in the renormalization of the standard model. So when we collect all the interaction terms of the Higgs boson, it can be written, in fact, in one line here. And here you can read off all the interactions of the Higgs boson with the massive elementary fields in the standard model, including W, Z boson, all the massive fermions, and the Higgs boson itself. And you can also read off the quantum numbers and the couplings, the trilinear couplings to the gauge bosons and the fermions, except for the electron, have now been measured at the LHC and within the errors of the experiments. They have been confirmed, and I will show you some results on the next few transparencies. So the quartic couplings, for example, to two-gauge bosons and to Higgs bosons, this is, and also the self-couplings, they are beyond the reach at the moment. There is hope that with a linear collider, also these couplings will be measured. And it is important to notice that the, in the standard model, the mass of the Higgs boson is a free parameter. Now, with the discovery of this particle, this mass has been measured, and it has been measured to a very high precision, as you will also see in the course of my talk. So now that
the quantum numbers, JPC, are they really confirmed experimentally?
Yeah, I will show you. That's a very good question. I will show you some results later. So, okay, so I come to this point. It's an important point, in fact. So now that we know the mass of the Higgs boson, all the parameters of the standard model have been measured, and we can make a very high precision predictions for all the properties of the Higgs boson. In particular, we can calculate the branching fractions of all the possible decay modes of the Higgs boson, and there has been a host of papers in the last 20-30 years where all these quantum corrections have been calculated, and there is a study group, LHC study group, who has been putting all these results together and coming up with these very precise predictions, which have been verified experimentally. And also, of course, the production cross sections at the LHC have been predicted to very high precision. Here are results for the two energies of run one. And so maybe I should also mention here what are the most important production mechanism. The dominant production mechanism actually is a loop-induced process here. This is the so-called gluon fusion mechanism, which proceeds through heavy quark loops. It is dominant, although it is loop suppressed, because there is an enormous gluon luminosity at such high energies as the LHC. Then there is a vector boson fusion. This means we have such a process here. So you eject from the quark lines here, you eject at either W or Z bosons that fuse to the Higgs boson. This has an important impact. And also there is Higgs Strahlung, so-called Higgs Strahlung. So this means we have a Trillian process and radiate the Higgs boson from the gauge boson line. And then important is also the radiation of the Higgs boson of the heavy quark. So you have a heavy quark pair production like here, and you radiate the Higgs boson. This is an important production cross-section, and less important is the single top Higgs production, so associated top Higgs production, which proceeds via such processes, but all these processes are amenable at the LHC. Now I come to your question, the verification of the quantum numbers. Maybe I should go back by two transparencies, because here I had a little note that I didn't mention here. So you see, you can see from the decay products of the Higgs boson that it must have charge zero. Also, charge conjugation quantum number also follows, because, for example, if you have a decay to two photons, the charge conjugation is minus one, but you have two photons, so it's plus one. That's also established from the observation maybe of this channel. And then you can also say something about the spin, because if it decays, for example, into a fermion pair, it must have either spin zero or spin one. If it decays to two gauge bosons, like spin one bosons, it could have a spin zero, spin one, and spin two. And but the spin one assignment is excluded by the Landau-Young theorem, which tells you that a massive spin one boson cannot decay to two massless quanta, which relies on very general arguments. Okay, so the question is it rather spin zero or is it spin two? And then also the parity is something that should be clarified. And this has been done very nicely. And here I quote results from the ATLAS collaboration. There's a similar study also by CMS, by the other general purpose detector from the LHC. So I should explain this. So this is a log likelihood representation of the data. And the spike here, this is the standard model assignment. So for example, here you would test, so this is the standard model assignment. So you have a dimension 3 coupling of the Higgs to the vector boson pair. This says spin 0 Higgs and positive parity. And here you test this against the negative parity assignment, again for spin 0. So you would have a coupling like this, where this is the conjugate vector boson field strength with the epsilon tensor dotted in. And you see the blue, this is the assignment, the standard model assignment, and the red one, this is the hypothesis of negative parity. And you can see here, this is the standard model value. So it's this hypothesis is excluded by more than 99% confidence level. And there's also the possibility to have a dimension 5 coupling for the correct quantum number, spin 0, and positive parity. And this is tested here, and also that is excluded, this higher dimensional coupling is excluded.
What's the difference between the last one and first one? It's the same coupling.
It's higher dimensional. So you this is dimension 3, and this is dimension...
How much shell it doesn't matter.
So this is dimension 5, and you need here this...
They are equal one with other with coefficient proportional to the masses, right?
So, I mean, what they did is they tested the Lagrangian tensor structure. You can use it. Yes?
You cannot differentiate it as amplitude on the mass shell. It's the same amplitude. So.
I disagree. I mean, why don't you take a look at this this paper here? It's very well explained how the analysis is done.
No. why you need to see the paper? I do not need to see the paper to see the, on the mass shell, it is the same structure. And you can see this yourself.
And so here you have an additional scale.
Sorry?
This is a dimension 5 coupling.
Okay, so it's a ratio of masses to this scale, but it is just another coefficient for additional coupling, HVB. You cannot differentiate it looking at the mass shell amplitude.
So what is done here, you take this coupling and you get this result, and here you take this coupling.
From the Higgs or from the photon?
But actually, the data, I think, uses an off shell Z, doesn't it?
Yeah, so if you are going off shell, but then,
well, one of them
then
is
it's not just amplitude on the shell.
But if you have neutrons, I mean, if a decays, a photon decays into dileptons, would you be not?
What do you say?
If you have to have twice a dilepton decay.
No, but how you differentiate this? If you are talking about a decay of H to, say, mu, imagine that everything
is
on the shell.
Mu plus mu minus, or something like this.
When there is a Higgs boson of 125 GeV, it decays in one real Z boson and one off-shell Z boson, right?
They usually, of course, because the W boson are here. However, in terms of analysis, it's just it means that you are adding up the part in algorithm, which is by equation of motion is equivalent to that one. And then it's different only how you go off shell, right? I agree that, no, but it is not related to amplitude. I mean, it doesn't mean that it's a new vertex, really. Of course, you are relating vertex of one dimension related to vertex of high dimension. I agree that, I mean, off shell it would be, but it's the same as to add something off shell, right?
Would you mind if I just continue? Because this is really not the topic of my
talk. It's up to you.
Thank you. Okay, similarly, the spin 2 assignment has been checked. So now you have a spin 2 Higgs tensor, and it couples to the energy momentum tensor of the gluon field or the quark field. And also here are these log likelihood presentations, and you see also that this assignment has been ruled out experimentally. Okay, how about the couplings? I also said that the couplings have been verified. So, of course, the cross sections and branching fractions have been measured. And here, ratios of measurements are plotted against the theoretical predictions, in fact, normalized to 1. And you see that the overall picture is very encouraging. This is taken from a combined analysis of ATLAS and CMS of last year. And so the overall agreement is rather nice. Now, keeping in mind that the Higgs boson is such a narrow resonance of you cannot measure the widths yet, but it is you calculate it to be 4 GeV. I'm sorry, 4 MeV. And therefore, the narrow width approximation works in an excellent fashion. So you can, whenever you have production and decay with a Higgs resonant, you can factorize this in a production cross-section and a branching fraction in this way. And then you have all these measurements, and you can individually extract these numbers. And what you can do to measure the so-called signal strength is to normalize these measurements, these extracted numbers, with respect to the standard model predictions. And that ratio should be 1, and you can see here also how nicely this works. There is a little deviation here for the top, but there's also some there's some statistical fluctuations, and for example, ATLAS agrees within a little bit more than 1 sigma. And the same you can do also for the branching fractions. Also here the overall agreement is very nice. This is just to show you how well it works. And if you go a little bit more deeper into the structure, you can even introduce coupling modifiers. These are dimensionless numbers which multiply the couplings of the Higgs boson to the other particles. And then you know, in a tree-level process, you would have a quadratic dependence in this ratio of on the coupling modifier, and you can do this for the production and decay cross sections. And in the standard model, of course, all these coupling modifiers are unity, and also this is very nicely somehow shown in these figures how nicely it agrees. And I found this very impressive. So here, you take a square root or not, depending on whether you have bosons or fermions. And so then all the measurements should be on this straight line here on the log-log plot. And even the muon coupling of the Higgs boson has been measured, and it agrees with the standard model assignment. So this is, I think, rather impressive. And I could continue showing you such results, but this is not the topic of my talk. I would like to conclude here this part of the talk by saying that I think we can call this the Higgs boson of the standard model, as we talk of the top quark of the standard model, or the Z boson or W boson of the standard model, with this kind of evidence. I also mentioned that the mass has been measured very precisely, and the mass is measured essentially from two decay channels, namely the two photon channel here, and also the gold-plated decay mode, which goes to 4 Z bosons and then to 4 charged leptons. They are mostly muons. And this allows for independent measurements. So there's by ATLAS and by CMS. And if you combine everything, you find this number, which is close to 125, with a very small error. So this mass is not now known much better than, for example, the mass of the top quark. And the mass of the top quark is one of the central ingredients that is responsible for the question whether the standard model vacuum can be stable or not, way up to the Planck scale. Now, let's put this in a more global framework. We have been seeing or probing the Higgs boson before via its virtual effects in quantum corrections. So there have been, of course, all these measurements at LEP, at the LHC, at the SLC, and also at lower energy colliders, even atomic parity violation, and so on, is sensible to the Higgs boson mass. And before the discovery, we had this kind of a picture. This is the famous parabola, the blue parabola. And this was all excluded by LHC search and just by LEP searches. And there was this little window here. And this is where the Higgs boson has been found. And you see the agreement with all these previous high-precision electrophic measurements is very good. So we are in a range where delta chi-squared is below 1. So this is very nice. So everything fits together. Now, of course, also these kind of pictures had been shown like 20 years ago already. there is the scale of new physics, where new physics sets in, taking the standard model as an effective theory. And there are these kind of bounds on the Higgs boson mass. The upper bound is now unnecessary or is obsolete in some sense. This is the triviality bound. And this is the vacuum stability bound. And you can see with a Higgs mass of 125, so this bound is no longer relevant, but this one is. And the question is, where does the new physics in some sense set in? Up to which scale can the standard model be valid? And this is the main point of my talk. Okay, in order to answer such a question, you need an appropriate theoretical framework. So this means you have to renormalize the standard model. And the question is, how do you do that? What is the best strategy? And keeping in mind that the scale, so if you want, is the scale, the renormalization scale, or the scale where we consider the standard model, can vary over many orders of magnitude. V is the vacuum expectation value. That was 250 GeV. The Planck mass is at 10 to the 19 GeV. So there are very many orders of magnitude. And in order to somehow cope with such a scenario, you need to use some minimal subtraction renormalization in dimensional regularization that gives rise to running couplings. And the so-called MS-bar renormalization is a standard procedure. It's one of the possible minimal subtraction schemes. And if you use this scheme, then all the couplings of the standard model depend on this dimensionful, as this is called the Toft mass, which you introduce in dimensional regularization. So then there is a two-step procedure. The first procedure is to consider the evolution of all these couplings with the scale. This is so-called the renormalization group evolution. And so you have to calculate the beta functions for all the couplings. So this is here written down. These are the tree-level result, I mean the one-loop results for the most important couplings, the self-coupling of the Higgs, the top Yukawa coupling, and the strong coupling constant. The fact that this is negative has given rise to a Nobel Prize here. And so now there has been a revolution since 2012, because all these beta functions have now been calculated exactly at the three-loop level. This was achieved by two groups, the group in Karlsruhe and the group in Dubna by Bednyakov et al. And so now we know this much better. So this is one ingredient. But the other point, and that should not be forgotten, is that you have at some point to start. So you need an additional condition for the renormalization group evolution of all these couplings. Yes?
When do you start feeling the renormalizations?
Okay, so in order to get these beta functions, you need to have a renormalization scheme that allows you to have a mass. For example, if you use the on-shell scheme, that you can, if you are dealing with electroweak phenomena, it's very convenient to use the electroweak on-shell scheme. It does not.
You don't know what to say. The dependence appears beyond second loop order.
Right? Yeah. So when you realize the first order always starts.
Well, and here there is no kind of dependence.
Sure. Okay, what I wanted to say is that in order to have beta functions, you need to work in a minimal subtraction scheme. Okay, if you work for.
You can use the other scheme, and the first order in one loop would be the same.
Okay, so for example, I just mentioned a scheme that is very very familiar, very frequently used in electroweak perturbations. It is called electroweak on-shell scheme. Mm-hmm. In the electroweak on-shell scheme, the parameters of the theory, including the couplings, the masses, the mixing angles, are not running. They do not depend on a scale, okay? So in order to have a evolution with scale, you need to have a Toft mass. And this means that you have to use minimal subtraction, dimensional regularization.
What about just cut off by hand? It also would be a subsucking scheme, and it would be given in one loop the same coefficient as
Yeah, but I'm not talking about that. You know, you are talking about the cutoff regularization that, of course, you can do. You have problems of gauge dependence and so on. So I think this is maybe something that people abandoned like 20 or 30 years ago. So I don't think it's relevant now to talk about this. Yes, but the question is, do these beta functions depend on the choice of minimal subtraction scheme? And I think the answer was given. So the first two orders are independent. And then, starting from this three-loop term, you have this dependence. Okay, but it's irrelevant also here because me, like anybody else in the field, is now using the minimal modified minimal subtraction scheme. Okay, which has a special treatment of the Euler gamma and the log of pi and so on. It's a technical, just a technical point. So as I said, there was a revolution in the calculation of all these functions. But the other important ingredient for this analysis is the determination of the initial conditions. So at some point where you start your evolution, so say, for example, the electroweak vacuum value or the mass of the top quark or so, you have to say which are the values of all these running parameters. And these initial conditions are sometimes called the threshold corrections because somehow you have a physical threshold where you have to determine the values. And so also this business is known for a long time. So a pioneering work was done by Alberto Serlin and his student, former student. That was 30 years ago. He was the first to create the notion of the threshold correction and to first calculate such a correction. And he did it for the most important coupling, namely the Higgs self-coupling. So this is the correction. You see, this is the running coupling that I was talking before. This is the on-shell mass of the Higgs boson. This is the Fermi constant. I will explain you later how this comes into the standard model. And the relationship between these two, between these observables, low energy observables, and the running coupling is the threshold correction. And this thing can be calculated in perturbation theory. So the first order, the first electroweak order was calculated by Serlin, and 20 years ago, Ralf Hempfling and I, we did the same thing for all the Yukawa couplings in the standard model, including the top quark, and you have it here. And by the way, the coefficient of the logarithm, this is just the beta function, okay? So this is the one-loop beta function coefficient that you can recover here, okay? So also here, there has been some recent developments, namely there are two groups that have somehow elevated this calculation to the electroweak two-loop level. So we have now precise expressions at the two-loop. And first, what was the mixed corrections? They are very large, the alpha-alpha S corrections. So one-loop electroweak, one-loop QCD. They were obtained by us. Then these leading top Yukawa corrections were obtained just shortly after us. And then people have worked, have evaluated the full two-loop electroweak corrections.
Which is the minimal mu where this applies to the weak interaction scale?
This is in fact arbitrary. So.
Yeah, but you, if you go below the top mass, you have then to rematch, right? I
mean, yeah, that's right. Yes. In QCD, for example, you would have like to match the five flavor theory to the six flavor theory. But this is all known. It can all be done. So I think, as you know, it is convenient to use the heaviest particle, like the top quark, as the matching scale. But you could go down and also do it.
But then I can say where it's normalized. Lambda mu equal to some, I don't know, physical quantity, which mu?
This was exactly his question. So it is somehow theoretically arbitrary where you use it, but there are sensible choices and unreasonable choices. And as I just discussed, or as he just proposed, a reasonable choice, and that's actually what we do, is to use the mass of the top quark. Because then you are somehow, it's technically simpler because you don't have to match, to consider the decoupling of the theory of heavy particles from the theory, because you start with the heaviest particle. Okay, but of course, the choice of mu introduces some theoretical uncertainty, and this is something that we have, of course, to take into account to get our stability analysis with a theoretical uncertainty. Okay, so these are the two ingredients, and now how do we obtain these threshold corrections? Let me just explain it, because this is a central part of our own analysis. So now let's stay for a moment within the dimensional regularization with minimal subtraction. And as I told you before, we have the standard model in two phases, a symmetric phase and a broken phase. And depending on which phase you consider, it is convenient to use different sets of basic parameters, okay, what you consider basic parameters. Now, if you're in the symmetric phase, the only mass you have is the mass parameter of the Higgs potential, and you only have couplings otherwise. So these are your basic parameters in the symmetric phase. In the broken phase, it's different. You have all the masses now, so you might use those as basic parameters because they are easy somehow to extract experimentally, but you also need one coupling, and it has become customary to use the electroweak coupling because of its significance in QED. And so this would be a natural set of basic parameters in the broken phase. And of course, at the tree level, you know all these relationships. You know how E is related to the weak coupling constants, how the masses are related to the couplings by means of the vacuum expectation value. All this you know, and you also know how this vacuum expectation value can be expressed both in terms of the parameters of the symmetric phase and the broken phase. Now, these are all tree-level relationships, but in fact, it is possible to render these relationships exact, I mean, to organize your renormalization in such a way that these are all exact. This means exact to all orders of perturbation theory. The price to pay is that the vacuum expectation value loses its physical meaning, its physical significance beyond the tree level. So this means that the renormalized version of the vacuum expectation value does no longer tell you where the minimum of the potential is. So this is the price to pay, but the gain is much higher, namely you have very simple relationships between the MS bar renormalized parameters, meaning the masses and couplings, to all orders of perturbation theory. So then what you do in order to do the matching is a very simple observation, namely if you start with a bare Lagrangian, you do not yet know which renormalization scheme you use. In other words, the bare couplings, the bare masses, bare couplings are the same for all renormalization schemes. And this is the way how you can actually relate renormalized quantities in different schemes. Because these are just finite relationships, and they are somehow induced by the observation that the bare parameters are always the same. And for example, you can... I'm too fast, so I was already on the next transparency. I should tell you first something about the Onschild renormalization scheme. I mentioned it here. So in the Onschild renormalization scheme, you organize your renormalization in such a way that the inverse propagator, so this is for bosons, Higgs and W, this is for the Z boson, you have an admixture of the photon here, and also for fermions, you impose the renormalization condition that when P squared is on the mass shell, you have a zero here. So this you have the pole, you require that the physical pole appears on the physical mass. And this is the pole mass, the definition of pole mass. And then you have the fine structure constant, and in the Onschild renormalization scheme, you consider as an important basic process. You consider Thomson scattering. So this is when the virtuality of the photon goes to zero, and what you do is you arrange your renormalization in such a way that that the renormalized coupling absorbs all the radiative corrections. So this means that your one loop renormalized expression for Thompson scattering amplitudes has the same form as the tree level one. Okay, this can be done, but it can be only done for one process, and you choose Thompson scattering. So this is how it is done. There is some problem here. So people working on electric perturbations, they do not like this kind of assignment, because it in fact induces you large corrections. So of course, for low energy processes, this is very fine. But for example, if you want to consider physics at the electroweak scale, you will also get, you will always get large logarithms. So this, for example, if you do Z boson physics, this will be the Z boson mass. This is the electron mass. So you have a large logarithm, which is okay, multiplied by a small coupling, but still at some point, this becomes very large and you might have to worry about resummation effects and so on. There's another point, namely the hadronic uncertainties. As you know, the fine structure constant also receives renormalization effects from hadronic loops. And those, if you are at low scales, you cannot just calculate in perturbation theory. You have to use the optical theorem and take dispersion relations related to the total cross-section. And all this induces theoretical uncertainties, which is not very nice. And this was already observed a long time ago, again, by Alberto Sierlin, who introduced the famous delta R parameter. And so what he does, he considers the muon decay, or any low-energy leptonic process, and matches the QD corrected amplitude in the Fermi theory, which you can do, with the full one-loop or higher-loop corrected amplitude in the standard model. So in this way, you get an expression of this Fermi constant, which is outside the standard model, if you wish, in terms of standard model parameter. So this is a very important thing here, which is makes all the calculations very simple, because all these large logarithms are avoided. And we also use this here, but in a very strict mathematical sense, as I will tell you later. Now we come to matching, and this is by the observation, as I said, that the bare, for example, the bare mass is always the same in all schemes. So you have the on-shell renormalization, and this is the MS bar renormalization with all these renormalization constants here, which are just numbers or fractions of masses and so on. So this is why the minimal subtraction scheme is so popular, because the beta functions under renormalization constants have a very simple polynomial structure. Okay, and for the couplings, you introduce the Fermi constant. In this way, you have a modified version of Alberto's delta R parameter, and this is the running vacuum expectation value. And in fact, in this very nice paper by Abramek et al., it has been shown how what is the appropriate field theoretic approach beyond the one-loop approach by Sierlin of how to calculate or how to define this modified delta R parameter. So what you do, you take any low-energy leptonic process here, you dress it with the wave function normalizations of these particles, and then you apply the hard procedure, which means that you nullify the external form momenta and put the light fermions, light fermion masses to zero before the loop integration. And this way, you have a dramatic cancellation of infrared singularities. This is a finite result. And on this side, you have the finite renormalized MS bar parameters and this quantity sought for, which enters this relationship here. So this is what we do. Okay, now putting everything together. We have as I said, we had three ingredients. One was the MS bar scheme in the symmetric phase, the MS bar scheme in the broken phase, and the on-shell scheme. And we now put everything together. And in this way, we obtain the running couplings at some matching scale expressed in terms of the low energy observables and these threshold corrections. And this one here is a derived quantity, so it follows from these two. But you see, this is how we evaluate the running fine structure constant. We are not using Thompson scattering data or any hadronic cross sections. So it's all done in terms of these threshold corrections. Now, of course, the right-hand side also depends on E. So you have to evaluate this in an iterative mode, or you have to expand also in couplings of E and arrange it. So this is how we avoid this Thompson scattering problem. I should also say something about a strong coupling constant, because here this is really the value that is quoted in the particle data book, is for the five-flavor QCD, so we have the top quark somehow integrated out. But of course, you don't only have to add the top quark, you also have to add all the other electroweak particles. So this means that this is a non-trivial threshold correction that relates the pure, the puristic QCD coupling constant in the five-flavor theory with all the rest of the standard model. And this is now the strong coupling in the standard model with all particles included. Now, this is all we need for our analysis, but since it is so important, let me also talk about the notion of running masses. As you are experts on QCD, you know, of course, the notion of running mass in QCD. But there is a subtlety when you include also electroweak corrections. Namely, this is the fact that when you introduce MS bar scheme, you have to decide what to do with tadpole contributions. Okay, and just at this stage, I can just tell you that you a rigorous relation between the pole masses, which are manifestly gauge independent by the S matrix theorem, and the running masses of the MS bar scheme can be written in terms of these quantities here. So you have the threshold corrections that you take from here, and you combine them with the delta R bar parameter. So this is a manifestly gauge independent and finite relationship. So we also is available everything exactly at the two loop level. But I would like to spend a few words on these mass relations, even though they are not necessary for my analysis. So how do we calculate the threshold corrections? Of course, we have to consider two loop self-energy diagrams. So this is done here. You can almost not see it. So this is for the Higgs self-coupling. We have to consider the Higgs propagator, and then for the top Yukawa coupling threshold correction, you have to consider the top propagator. And as you can see also here, there are these tadpole contributions which need to be taken into account. Okay, so that's maybe not so interesting for you. There are some packages on the market that we can use to generate the diagrams and to reduce these tensor two-loop diagrams to scalar ones and to get our basis integrals. But maybe what is interesting for you, we have released a program which is written in C++, but also as a Mathematica interface that you can very simply use to determine all the running parameters of the standard model once you input the pole masses and the fine structure constant. So that's available from this link. It's also been published in Computer Physics Communication. Okay, so let me discuss some numerical results of the threshold correction. So this is the threshold correction to the Higgs self-coupling in units of 10 to the minus 4. And this is the same thing for the top Yukawa coupling, again in units of 10 to the minus 4. Here this is the one-loop corrections, if you like. This is the Serlin correction, Serlin-Zucchini correction of 30 years ago. And you only have to consider this value here. The other ones are obsolete now. So you see this is a large correction. This is a 10%, 11% reduction. And then this is maybe a surprise. The mixed alpha S corrections are almost as large as this one-loop term here. And these are the full two-loop corrections they're given here. And this is done in the gauge-less limit, where all the gauge Poisson masses are put to zero. This is a good approximation also. So you see there's a reasonable perturbative convergence, and this is the total effect. It's a 25% reduction. And for the top Yukawa coupling threshold correction, everything is, of course, dominated by QCD. These are the really large corrections, and these include up to four loops now. So last year, the four-loop correction between the MS bar and the pole mass has been calculated. Steinhauser et al., and this is all included here. And the one-loop electroweak corrections are small against that one, and also here's a reasonable...
They don't look like a correction because it looks like 0.6, for MHL, 0.6. So I mean, there's no smallness also.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. It's a small effect, yes. It's a big effect.
But then you need to sum up more than just correction, right?
No, it converges very fast. That has been established, yes. So what you say is a reflection of the fact that if you exclude all electroweak effects, if you just consider QCD, the pole mass of the top, if you take it to be 172, mm-hmm. this means that the MS bar mass is 10 GeV smaller, is 162. So it's a big shift, okay? It's a big shift. And you have to first tell the experimentalist what to measure, because the experimental error is much smaller than that. Yes. And this is just this number here, okay? But also you have to consider to make a precise prediction for the stability of the vacuum. You have to also consider all the other corrections, and these are the numbers. Yes.
Quite a few of us are puzzled by you characterizing that as a 25%. And there's a bit of elementary arithmetic makes it 2%. Mm-hmm. So do you mean 10^-4 or 10 to the minus?
Maybe I did something wrong. Yes, you're of course right.
So which is it? Are these right and?
So the numbers are right, and let's see. So this is you're quite right. This is a 2% effect, and this is a 6% effect. I'm very sorry.
Thanks.
Okay. So this was for the top quark, and for the bottom, the numbers are given here. So this is the relationship between the bottom Yukawa coupling and the top mass. The pole mass of the bottom quark and the bottom Yukawa coupling, and this is the convergence that you can see here. So this is a graphical representation. So you see here the threshold correction to the Higgs self-coupling and the top Yukawa coupling, and so these are the different orders. So here you see one thing which is quite nice, namely, when we consider as the matching scale the top quark, which is about 170, then we see that the correction incidentally is almost zero. So this threshold correction, if you choose the an appropriate scale, you have the bonus that the correction is also numerically very small. And this happens to be also the case for the top quark. Also here, when you take 170, you're close to zero. So this means that the theoretical stability of this analysis will be very good.
Is that a coincidence?
It's a coincidence. Now, as I mentioned, there's an interesting feature of electroweak physics. It's a spontaneously broken gauge theory. So you have to deal with tadpoles, and has been known for many years that the counter term, like the on-shell counter term, is only gauge independent if you include these beasts here, so these tadpole contributions. So this is a zero momentum Higgs line, and then here you can have everything that couples to the Higgs. So this could be gauge bosons, could be heavy fermions, and since you have gauge bosons in particular, this also means that these guys carry gauge dependence. So this is one important or one negative somehow feature. The other one is that due to the presence of this line here, you have inverse powers of the Higgs boson mass, and this can be dangerous if the Higgs is light, and the Higgs is light. 125 is a low value, so these are numerically big effects. And our way to approach this is just as I have explained to you when I talked about the Higgs potential. We adjust, and this we take to be a relationship between the bare couplings. So we adjust the Higgs expectation value in this way, and this exactly eliminates the Lindner term in the bare Lagrangian of the standard model. And if you do that, then there are no tadpole counter terms. So we have to include, we have to calculate these diagrams, and have to include them order by order, both in the proper scattering diagrams and also in the counter term amplitudes. And this ensures, in fact, finiteness and also gauge independence. And we have established via explicit calculation that in this mode of calculation, all these threshold corrections, including also delta R bar, are gauge independent exactly through the two-loop order. And we can look at the inverse powers of the Higgs boson mass, and it turns out that everything is fine for the threshold corrections. If you send the Higgs boson mass to zero, they will be finite. In the case of the Higgs self-coupling, you have two inverse powers, but you have to keep in mind that to get the self-coupling, you have to inject again two powers of the Higgs boson mass. So that means that the self-coupling of the Higgs is also finite in the limit when the Higgs boson goes to zero. This is quite different for this delta R bar parameter. This has four inverse powers of the Higgs boson mass. And this tells you that these MS bar renormalized electrolytic masses that are introduced for the bosons and the top quark, they have a very bad dependence on these tadpoles. So they are numerically large corrections. And what we actually proposed in order to avoid this problem is not to define the MS bar masses for the electroweak particles in this puristic way, but to rather, at least here for the fermions, to just rescale the Yukawa couplings, which have this well-defined Higgs mass dependence, just to rescale them by the mentionful coupling and with the Fermi constant. In this way, you generalize the running, for example, the running top quark mass in such a way that the QCD correction remains the dominant correction and that the electroweak corrections are small. Okay, so this is all I wanted to say. And okay, tadpole cancellation, it's already somehow alluded in the previous transparency, but let me make it explicit for at the one-loop level. So you have, as I said, the on-shell mass counter term contains a tadpole. And if you go from the on-shell scheme to the MS bar scheme, you have to just drop the divergent pieces, but the tadpole, the finite parts of the tadpole remain here. But in the Yukawa coupling renormalization, you also have to renormalize the electroweak vacuum expectation value. So you have these two terms, and they have the same tadpole dependence, so it cancels out here. Not here, but here. And now if you go, so there's an exact cancellation of tadpoles, and this exact cancellation remains true if you go to this order alpha, alpha s. So it's very complicated here, but has been established for the top and also for the bottom in our paper. But now a new feature appears. If you go to full two-loop electroweak, there is no complete cancellation of the tadpoles anymore. So there are finite parts of the tadpole that remain in your finite corrections. And this is why it is important to properly treat tadpole counter terms. Okay, maybe I should skip this one here. This is an explanation why our definition of the running quark masses is superior. Okay, you can see it here just by looking at these numbers. So you have here the QCD corrections. This is the 10 GV shift that I was mentioning previously. This is overcompensated by the tadpole, by the electric tadpole corrections. So here for the top quark is very nice that if you use the puristic mass, you get almost a complete cancellation of all the corrections. However, in the case of the bottom, you find that your perturbation expansion doesn't converge anymore. You get larger corrections if you go to higher orders. And so maybe it would work, the heuristic definition would work for the top, but not for the bottom. And since we want to have a scheme that works for all the quarks, it is better to use this running quark mass that starts from the Yukawa coupling and just rescales it. Now, let me come to the analysis of vacuum stability. So we put everything together now, the beta functions and also the threshold corrections. And just for those of you who, just a reminder, what should we expect? How does it come? So when we talk about vacuum stability, we have in mind a situation where the top quark mass is much heavier than the Higgs boson mass. And then the most important couplings in this game is the self-coupling of the Higgs and the top Yukawa coupling. And we just look at the one-loop relationships. If you drop this term here, if you just solve this and plug the solution in here and solve this equation, you find this. So this is very rough, but you can see that if the scale increases from the starting scale, that the coupling becomes smaller and smaller, and at some point it becomes negative. And where this happens, this is the breakdown. This is then the breakdown of the Higgs potential when the self-coupling becomes negative, and this is called the vacuum stability bound. Now, if we just use these dominant terms at one loop, we find that the scale is very low. These are just eight TVs, and you see that it's important to include all the other terms here and to go to higher orders and to use all the precision that we have to get a more realistic value for this criticality scale. Okay, now I would like you...
You define it as where lambda goes negative?
Yes.
But isn't it just a small range where it's negative?
Well,
it turns up again.
Yeah, sure. So this is just somehow in a nutshell to somehow motivate this whole analysis. So this is just at the one loop level with the dominant terms included. And this is the exact solution. If you only keep dominant terms at one loop, you get this solution. And of course, this, if you increase the scale, it will go negative and negative and negative. So it just monotonically goes down. And at some point, it crosses zero and continues to go down.
But
of course, if you, pardon?
In terms of cosmology, this 8 TeV would correspond to kind of short time or whatever, where it would be.
Well, this 8 TeV, as I said, is irrelevant because it's based on a wrong approximation.
No, I understand that it is not not exact statement, yes. But still, it would give you a certain scale in time, right, when we would cease to exist.
Yeah, of course. So this would mean that that we would not exist at all. Yes. Okay. Right. So this was just the motivation. Of course, we have to do much better. And there are two avenues that I would like to outline to perform this vacuum stability analysis. One is just by considering the self-coupling of the Higgs. This is just referring to the previous transparency, but to do it at the with two-loop matching and three-loop evolution. And then, so this means that you have, we impose two conditions. One is that the self-coupling is zero. Maybe, can you see all this? Maybe I should stand here. So here, this means that the self-coupling vanishes, but you also require that the beta function of the self-coupling vanishes. So you have two conditions. And this means you can determine not only the critical scale where this happens, but if you input either the top or the Higgs, then this allows you to evaluate the other one. So for example, if we think that we know what the pole mass of the top quark is, then from this condition we can evaluate the criticality scale and also the critical value of the Higgs boson mass, or vice versa. Now, this is very nice because in the way that we establish our renormalization, this is all gauge independent. But of course, these are couplings, renormalized couplings, and they refer to renormalization scheme. So in some sense, this analysis is scheme dependent. Okay. So this is what we have to keep in mind. So there is a theoretical uncertainty. Instead of using minimal subtraction, the modified minimal subtraction scheme, we could use some other minimal subtraction scheme or some momentum subtraction scheme and so on. So there is some uncertainty here. And in order to estimate this uncertainty, we can use a different approach. This is another approach that is very popular in the literature, namely to use the effective potential. This means that you calculate only the vacuum bubble diagrams in the standard model, where you introduce a classical scalar Higgs field, which takes the role of the vacuum expectation field, and then you perform this analysis. You get the effective potential, and then what you do, you have again two conditions. First of all, you would like to have the effective potential at the criticality scale to be the same as the Lechewick scale, so it should be the same value. So this means that these two minima should have the same depth. And also, you would like to have to be their minimum, so the first derivative should vanish. So it's again two conditions, and you can determine the criticality scale in either the critical Higgs mass or the critical top mass, depending on which other one you input. Now here, there's also a caveat, namely, in the way that has been done in these well-cited papers, this analysis is gauge-dependent because the effective potential is usually considered in the Landau gauge, and so all the results are gauge-dependent. Okay, now the gauge
potential is indeed gauge-dependent, yes. Itself, but in principle, you know, the value of minimum whatever could be gauge independent.
Yes, that's my next transparency.
Yeah.
Okay, but this was not realized in this paper here. Okay, but this has been known since Kuhlmann and Weinberg, that different power counting is necessary. So if you calculate the effective potential, it is not true that that one loop means next to leading order and two loop means next to leading order. You have to realize that the self-coupling comes with an h-bar if you are close to a minimum of a potential. This was already noticed in the original Kuhlmann-Weinberg paper. And if you take this into account, then you have to rearrange the loop results to what is leading order, next to leading order, next to leading order. There's even an infinite tower of loop diagrams, these daisy kind of diagrams that you have to take into account. And this was re-emphasized in this very nice paper by the Harvard group. If you do that, and this is what we adopt, then you get, in fact, gauge-independent results for at the minimum, as you mentioned. Okay. So in particular, you have to obey this relationship between the self-coupling and the other couplings, and then you require that the next to leading order effective potential stays positive if you are there or there, depending on what you do. There is now a remaining caveat, so this is gauge independent, and it is, of course, in a way, it is scheme dependent now, because you use a special way, use the effective potential and not the couplings. But there is another interesting feature here, namely the criticality scale from this analysis. It turns out to be beyond the Planck mass. So this is the question, what do you do about gravity correction? So at this, at latest, at this scale, you hit gravity, but gravity is lacking in this kind of this analysis. So it's a little caveat, but still it's good enough for us. We just would like to estimate the scheme dependence of our results. So now we have two approaches.
The loop expansion, I thought, is an expansion in H-bar. So it's somehow your deviation from the loop expansion?
So what happens is not quite true. I mean, it is true what you say if you are away from a minimum. But in the minimum, if you are the minimum of this potential analysis, you have to match a tree-level result with a one-loop result. And if you want to do that, so the tree-level result is proportional to the self-coupling of the Higgs, and the one-loop result carries an h-bar. In order to make this match, you have to assign h-bar to lambda. So you have to call, in some sense, lambda a loop coupling. Okay. So this is.
You're just talking about Kuhlmann-Weinberg.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
No.
Yes. So the loop. We are used to consider loop orders as the orders of perturbation theory, but if you are close to the minimum of the potential, this kind of idea is offset. Okay, so.
Yes, sure. If mu critical is super Planckian, then so how do you make sense of that in the context of gravity?
Well, actually, what these guys did is they introduced some higher dimensional effective operators. Okay, they inserted that, and in this way somehow they could manage to lower the scale, the criticality scale below the Planck mass.
So does it mean that gravity could cure the problem? I mean, gravity corrections could be.
Well, of course, this is always there. You know, if we consider the running close to the Planck mass, you know, there's always the question, where does gravity set in? Okay. So at the moment, we just have to ignore it, to close our eyes and do the analysis and to see what we get.
But it's extremely fishy if it's super Planckian. You basically lost your home.
Yeah, I agree. Yes, I agree. So we base our, I mean, fortunately in our setup where we use the running mass and the running coupling as the decisive quantity, it turns out that the criticality scale is below the Planck mass. It's not far away from the Planck, but it's still below. Yes. So we trust our analysis, but our analysis is based on a certain scheme.
Mm-hmm.
And since we would like to have a rigorous determination of the error, we need somehow also to estimate scheme dependence.
So in one scheme it's below and in another scheme it's above.
Yes, yes. But yeah, we're not paying attention to the criticality scale in this approach. Yeah. We just pay attention to the critical mass.
Yeah, but then it means that in certain sense you should stop yourself at mu, which is still, say, smaller than Max Planck, right? So in this way you're not reaching the minimum, of course, right? But you can only say that you have kind of tendency, whatever you see there, right? Because simply speaking, you are losing control after this.
Yes,
right?
Yes. So let me emphasize again. So we use this analysis only to estimate the uncertainty, the scheme dependence of our own analysis, okay? So now you can question the validity of our error analysis, but you cannot question our central results.
No, right, but if I will say that gravity was contributed comparably, then it still would be open question.
So when you say mu critical is greater than the Planck mass, is it much greater or is it on the same scale?
It's maybe one or two orders of magnitude beyond. It happens at 10 to the 21 or 10 to the 22 or something. You will see numbers just on the next transparency. So these are the critical parameters. So when there is no twiddle, this means it is our analysis based on the self-coupling and the beta function. When there is a twiddle, it refers to the reorganized Higgs effective potential. And so there in both cases, there are two approaches, namely one where you input the Higgs mass and you get a critical top mass and a criticality scale, and the other one where you input the pole mass of the top quark, which is not so precisely known, in fact, and you get a critical Higgs mass and an associated criticality scale. And you see here, this is 17 and 18. So these scales are below the Planck scale, where it is 19 point something. And these scales, you have 21 and 22, so they're a little bit above, okay? But what you can see, and this is nice, and this is why we think it's still useful what we do, you see that the criticality, for example, top mass that you get in our approach and their approach are very similar. They're just 200 MeV separated. And we assign this 200 MeV, we call this the scheme dependence. Okay, this is how we estimate the scheme dependence, yes? So we use this number, and we use this number, and we do not pay attention to that and that. Okay, so, and now of course you see here all these parameters that we have. There are parametric uncertainties that come from the lack of knowledge of the input parameters. Then there is this mu dependence, which is precisely the lack of knowledge, where should we start our evolution? Where do we somehow match the running parameters to the on-shell parameters, to the low-energy observables? And we take the top quark mass as the matching scale, but then we vary by factor 2 up and down, and we get this uncertainty. And there's also the possibility to estimate a truncation uncertainty.
But question? So say this critical value, like MT critical, it is at which correspond to this large mu, or I mean, how I should use this 171 GeV?
So the situation that we would like to create is that at some high scale, which is close to the Planck scale,
but it is in our scale measurement.
We would like the self-coupling to be zero, and at the same time its beta function to be zero.
Uh-huh.
So at the large scale, yes.
Yeah. But this critical value of mass refers to measurable mass of the quark or what?
Well, you can, of course. You know, this is the predicted criticality. I mean, if it turns out that the measured pole mass of the top quark happens to be this number, then now the standard model is critical. Okay, so this means that it's a very interesting situation. But I come to this later. This is in a way the interpretation of our results. Okay.
When it comes to assigning the error here, I mean, until the critical is internally inconsistent, basically. I mean, that whole sequence where the critical is above the Planck scale, the magnitude is doesn't make sense.
You mean these two?
Yeah, the two of these. So. And then presumably, to really set the error, you have to look only at mu that makes sense, and then look at the range of the top that you can get out of that. Because you've done a calculation that has no meaning to get the top.
Well, so in some sense, you know, the gravity is really outside this kind of. We know that gravity is there, and we should keep this in mind. But you know, from you know, but doing this analysis, it is all well defined in some sense. Okay, so we just use this. We know this is a drawback of this approach. We could use inject effective operators to get this scaled down, but then we have an uncertainty on the effective operators. Which one do we use, and so on and so forth. This is far too complicated. We wanted to have an easy assessment of the scheme dependence.
It's always the case that determining uncertainties perhaps bad recapturers.
Okay, so I take, you know, your criticism is justified, and but the point is that we trust our critical mass parameters, and
could be some conclusion made not going to the range of this large mu, but say stopping at mu where you believe that gravity is still, I mean, not contribute, right? Maybe you can, you see, maybe you can put some kind of constraints, right? Because, I mean, you're implying that gravity is not important.
Sure, I mean, it just comes down to this very simple picture that I showed here. So, so what we do, if you bend this as long as this minimum is as steep as that one, and you want to have a minimum, so of course you can impose different conditions. It's possible, yes. We did not do that. We just stick to this very intuitive picture, and we just noticed that the criticality scale is a little bit beyond the Planck scale. We ignore this at the moment because we're just interested in the critical masses to assess the uncertainty, the scheme dependence, scheme uncertainty on our values. Okay, now you might ask, how do we improve previous analysis? I would say the most important improvement is that with regards to our competitors that work with the effective potential, our analysis is manifestly gauge independent. But then the question is, these higher orders that were included or were calculated previously, how much are they, I mean, what is their importance really in terms of numbers? And so I would say that the most important effect on the central value comes from this very recently calculated relationship between the running top mass and the pole top mass. Okay, so this is became available last year, and the effect on the critical mass is very large. So for example, here we switch off this for loop correction, we switch it off, then we get this number, and if we include it, we get this number. So we see it's a 200 a 200 MeV shift in the criticality top mass, so this is very important. The full two-loop corrections go in a different direction. Their inclusion leads to a reduction of 110 MeV, just to give you ideas. And of course, we can do similar considerations for the critical Higgs mass. Okay, other corrections, for example, those that relate the the five flavor QCD, a strong coupling constant with the full standard model. Strong coupling constant is nice to have, but numerically is not very, not a big effect. Okay, so this is our combined result, putting it all together. Since the Higgs boson mass has been determined much more precisely than top quark mass, we take the point of view that our analysis determines the criticality pole mass of the top quark. So if the pole mass of the top quark would be this number, then we had a situation where the standard model is truly critical, you know, keeping aside at the moment gravitational effects, of course. So this is the result of our analysis that we get from the self-coupling. This is what we get from the effective potential. You see the numbers here, the errors are very similar. We have here 200 MeV effect, and we can combine. So we combine this, we increase this error and put this together. And this should be compared with the, at the moment, with the best experimental determination of the pole mass. And you see that they are very similar. Now, there is a caveat here, because in order to talk about the pole mass, you should include loop corrections, right? Because it's a renormalized mass. Now, in the Monte Carlo programs that are used by the CMS and ATLAS collaborations, they are basically tree level. They have some QCD effects like parton showering and so on. But in some sense, this should be taken with a grain of salt, and people are debating what is the difference between the true pole mass and the Monte Carlo mass. Here, this means Monte Carlo. So this is a kind of a fake pole mass. Okay, so this is a caveat that we have. And this is why we need a E plus E minus linear collider to have a good notion.
This way, yeah, you can say that you measure gravity. Because
yeah,
because this difference, right? And it strikes
this
difference by, you know, it's a gravity.
You're so fast, you know, just wait, it will come on. So just for, you know, just to illustrate this, this is the renormalization group flow. So this is the beta function of the self-coupling, and this is the self-coupling itself. And we start from here. This is where we start. This is at the top when we take the scale to be the top quark mass, and then we evolve, and we march in this direction, here. And if we take the Monte Carlo mass as our, you know, as our pole mass, which is wrong, of course, then we find that at 10 to the 10 somehow the self coupling becomes negative. Okay, but if we input the pole mass of the Higgs and we require criticality, then we run on this green line here, and we go right through this point here, and this happens at 10 to the 18. So this is the analysis. Okay, and you see also that the first condition is important. The second condition is automatic, because if you're up here, then to get a zero beta function is automatic. You get there's a kind of semi-fixed point up here. Okay, but let me not dwell too much on this plot.
Can you say what the red line was again?
The red line, the central one.
Yeah.
So this is when we take the Monte Carlo mass of the top quark to be the pole mass, if we identify this.
So is there no way to dress your pole mass into Monte Carlo pole mass?
Yeah, that's as I said, there is a very hot discussion about this point, and to do it right, one has to invest a lot of work, because the processes that are being used at the LHC to determine the top quark mass, they have very many particles in the final state. So this is a technical problem to calculate for this too many processes, full QCD corrections and electrical corrections and so on. So this partly has been achieved, but there is still a long way to go. But people are using effective field theories like soft collinear effective field theory and some arguments how to relate this Monte Carlo mass to the true pole mass of the top, and they assign an error of about 1 TeV. Some say 800 MeV, or this is kind of the ballpark. I would be more conservative. I would say the top quark is an unstable fermion. It has a width of 2 GeV, so I would assign just the 2 GeV uncertainty between this Monte Carlo mass and the true pole mass. I think this is a conservative estimate.
Yeah, but say this kind of ambiguity in, you know, this, it's a world of lambda, right? I mean, because the part which is due to, you know, kind of this
algorithmic
singularities, right, which you can sum
up. You mean lambda QCD?
Yeah, lambda QCD.
Yeah.
So lambda QCD is already, I don't know, few hundred maybe, right, if you will take this estimate.
Yeah, I think this renormalized ambiguity in the face of this new for loop correction has been estimated to be about 100 or 150 MeV. So this is still very small compared to this other uncertainty that we have. So you're quite right. I mean, the notion of a pole mass is problematic for quarks, right, due to confinement, yes. But for the top, I think it's okay because an unstable particle.
No, right, but I mean, it doesn't take away this,
sure.
Overload down the direction, right? Yes. Even, of course, you realize that there is a piece, right, but there is a shift of center.
Yeah. Okay, so so this is the famous phase diagram that you have seen in many conferences before by other authors. So so this is the range of absolute stability in the plane spanned by the Higgs mass. These are the pole masses of the Higgs and the top. So this is absolute stability. This is the criticality line. And the error bar, you know, that we assign comes from just from the most important input, which is the strong coupling, because the mTOP and mHiGS are input in this plane. So it's the uncertainty in the strong coupling constant. And this is the area of metastability. I have not talked about this demarcation line here. So what you do is you compare the lifetime of the of our vacuum with the age of the universe. Okay, so if you say that the lifetime of this, you know, for the tunneling from our electric vacuum to the deeper vacuum at large scale, so if this tunneling probability is smaller than compared to the age of the universe, you would call it metastable. Okay. So and here you see these are isolines of constant constant coupling and also a constant beta function here. Okay, so this is okay. And now if you put everything together also with the latest determination of the top quark pole mass, so there is a combined analysis per ATLAS and CMS that comes up with this number here. And this is really the upshot of my talk. So this is the band of criticality in the mTOP and Higgs plane. And what you see here, this is the one sigma ellipse for Higgs and top quark mass. So you see there's an overlap. And this is the two sigma ellipse here. So you know, what can we see here? What does it mean? Well, I think everybody will agree that there's some intriguing conspiracy of the standard model particle masses. So it seems that the criticality scale is very close to the Planck scale. But this is what you said, right? What?
We just used 10 to the 18 on the magician's slide, the reduced Planck.
Ah. So what I obtained as a criticality scale in our analysis that is based on the self-coupling and the beta function are numbers that are a little bit below the Planck scale, remember? So there was the logarithm was 18.
Well, it matters whether you think strong gravity sets in until the 18.
So these are the numbers that we got, and they're a little bit below the Planck. I mean, the log of the Planck scale would be 19.2 or something.
There are different definitions of the Planck scale, right? Again, there's the reduced Planck mass.
Yes. So they're using, yes, okay.
Which one?
And on the other.
They're using the one, you know, where the value is 10 to the 19. So I think it's the regular definition. Of course, you know, we come into subtleties, okay? So, but qualitatively, I think that there is some conspiracy that I talk about. Sorry.
If you go back to,
sure.
I think it was two slides, three slides. Let me see. There.
Yes.
See, I thought you were using the reduced Planck mass, 10 to the 18.
No, the number here that refers to our analysis. This is our criticality scale. This is what we obtain as a criticality scale, yes? So this is just, this doesn't contain any Planck mass. So it's all coming from electroweak analysis. Okay. Okay, now we can start to be philosophers. So as I also told you, that this criticality scale is stable with respect to parametric and higher order uncertainties. There's people call this asymptotic safety. So this also helps us here. And the question now is, since there is this conspiracy, I mean, the Higgs mass could have been quite different, could have been 110. It would have been discovered at lab, could have been 150, but it turns out to be 125. So this means that is there some relationship between the Planck mass and the standard model parameters? This is what you suggested. So this would mean, this would raise the question, could electroweak scale be determined by Planck scale physics? Or could there even be an implicit reduction of the fundamental couplings? I mean, this is a very important question. So the Planck mass somehow has no reference to the electroweak scales. But if there is a relationship, then one scale is redundant. We only need one fundamental scale less in physics. So this would be really remarkable. Okay, these are all open questions, and I'm sorry I don't have the time to answer them here. But let me make some outlook also. I don't know how much time, so I should stop maybe. I just would like to just to mention that people have thought beyond that, so we have seen that the standard model does very well. And the notion that we need a grand unified theory at, I don't know, 10 to the 16 GeV because of the vacuum, of the breakdown of the vacuum stability, I think is no longer true. We, of course, have deficits in the standard model. There are things that the standard model cannot describe, but I think the vacuum stability is now on the safe side. But the question is, what are the cosmological implications? And people would like to make the standard model even more fundamental than it is maybe thought to be. And this means that does the standard model tell us about cosmological features? And the idea is that you can relate the notion of inflation to the Higgs boson because you need an inflaton to generate inflation. And so there is now a scalar field in the standard model, and you can try to identify the Higgs field with the inflaton. And then, of course, you have to say how it couples. So these people assume there is a non-minimal coupling of gravity, this means of the Ricci scalar, to this bilinear Higgs field term with some coupling strengths. This can be responsible for inflation. And so I don't want to go into details. This is a very nice story. And people have shown this includes also gravitational effects and also finite temperature effects. But there is a closed story, so you can imagine how from a chaotic initial state of inflation, you get down to our standard model where we live, you know, in the vacuum expectation values, all explained in this nice story here. So it's possible. And okay, as you have seen, one of the critical cornerstones here of input parameters is the pole mass of the top quark. And so this is an open issue. What is the precise value of it? Are we really at the criticality or not? And an answer to it can come from an international linear collider, which is run as a top, both as a top and a Higgs factory. So this would allow us to pin down the error of the pole mass to maybe 100 MeV. We cannot go below that because of the Renormalian problem. There are some fundamental stop in precision, but also for the Higgs boson mass, we can go below what we have at the moment. So at the moment, the error is like 200 MeV, could be brought down by a factor of 5 or more. Then,
but in certain sense, what is measured, it's not the pole mass because large fields, right? So you can say that you already kind of running at 1 GeV, right? Because your fields of the order of 1 GeV, right?
So in fact, at the linear collider, you have a 1S peak. If you consider the excitation curve of top pair production, then you have the remainder of troponium. Okay, so it's smeared out as a 1S peak, and using effective field theory, non-relativistic QCD, in fact, and also QED, you can determine the mass parameter to very high precision. It's called the 1S mass, for example. Yes. There's also the potential subtracted number of short distance masses that you can determine very precisely from the excitation curve of a plus and minus, and that you can relate using for loop perturbation theory to the pole mass. Yes, so this is what I mean here, and so the analysis that have been done by the expert indicate that with a linear collider you can bring it down. This means that these are where we are now, and you could bring it down to the small ellipses, and then you can tell is it in the line of criticality or not. Okay, so this is an answer that maybe the LHC cannot do, but with a linear collider you can do it. I mentioned this already, so standard model is more fundamental as we may have thought before the discovery of the Higgs boson. But there are open problems, and these are the most burning ones. Why are the neutrino masses so small? Solution of the strong CP problem. What is the origin of dark matter? How can we understand the baryon asymmetry of the universe? And then, of course, the long-standing problem, how do we unify electroweak theory with gravity on a quantum level? And so this, of course, maybe this is a nuclear theory program. These are the burning questions of particle physics. You know, there are interesting approaches. I think some of the most interesting and most promising proposals go in the direction of so-called Higgs portals, where you have a new scalar particle which lives in the hidden sector of the standard model and has a coupling to the bilinear term of the Higgs field. And recently there has been, a very interesting proposal in the literature by my colleague Andreas Ringwald and others who have made up a scenario which seems to solve all these problems at one sweep. And of course it would be very interesting to find ways how to somehow test such scenarios. But I think, you know, and that's my personal opinion, I don't think that supersymmetry has a place in any of these approaches. It's not necessary as we stand here, and also LHC has shown no signals of new physics at the moment. Thank you so much for your attention.
Is there any room for false generation on fermions, or if it's completely excluded by stability of vacuums?
Well, I think the notion of a force fermion has disappeared a long time ago, already with the precision data from LEB and SLC, namely through the T parameter, or some people call it the rho parameter. So if you had a force generation, it could only be there if the force generation fermions would all be mass degenerate. So as soon as you have a reasonable mass splitting between the up and down components of the generation, then you would have very huge effects that are ruled out by the precision electroweak data.
There is no data. Just by forget about data. Is it theoretically excluded or not?
Well,
kind of
know,
motivation, philosophical question.
Yes. Well, I think there is no need. I mean, you know, from the theoretical point of view, if you want to introduce a complication to the theory, you have to have a goal in mind. Okay, what problem do you want to solve with it? And I don't think there is any problem that you can solve, that an open problem that you can solve with a forced generation. So from the theoretical point of view, I think it is nonsensical, or it's not necessary to introduce a forced fermion generation. And from the experimental point of view, I would say, unless it is absolutely mass degenerate, you know, it's ruled out. And I think it's very unlikely that it's mass degenerate, because if you go from the first to the second to the third generation, in the third generation you have this enormous mass splitting between pot and top. Why should there be no mass splitting in a fourth generation?
Yes, related question is there, is it possible to have particle heavier than T quark? Because T quark is already nearly critical.
Well, sure, it is possible, and the only way to find is to test experimentally, right? So it's possible.
Well, it's much heavier besides, you know, if it's standard model, because the collar coupling and the air is non-perturbative.
You can answer. Maybe your question is, how would a fourth generation affect my analysis?
Yeah, sure.
Well, it would affect very much because of the large Yukawa coupling. Yes. So if the fourth generation masses come through the Higgs mechanism, this is of course the assumption.
Of course, yes.
Okay. If it comes through the Higgs mechanism, you have very large.
Particle heavier than T quark, is it completely excluded by vacuum stability?
Well, I mean, what you have is that, yeah, I think so, yes. As you can see it already here, so we get an upper bound on the top quark mass, right? So if the top was heavier than, 173 or so, you would have this instability of the standard model Higgs potential, and the fourth generation would make this impossible, yes.
But if the Yukawa becomes large, the whole analysis goes up.
That's another point. You may not trust your analysis because of a lack of perturbativity.
Okay.
what would happen if you would test supersymmetry at these gut scales only? I mean, suppose these symmetry breaking already there.
Well, you know, if you have supersymmetry, then of course it's a different situation. Yes. So
but it's what counteract, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. But you see, of course, you know, if you make your model more complicated, anything goes. You can play, and people, you know, there's a vast literature on this. Yes. But in the standard model setting, to add a fourth generation is excluded, I think, experimentally, and also would make this analysis would invalidate. You know, would have no stability.
Thank you. Good question. So again, in the pole mass versus say the bar mass. So you mentioned that you use the 1s mass and the 2s bar to define it, and you do that because it eliminates basically all of the infrared issues in dealing with the pole mass. So presumably in the event generator you can extract the top mass at some renormalization scale in the MS bar scheme and then do a comparison of that, and that should have a much better behavior for terms of expansion than the pole mass.
Yeah, that's a very good question, a very good point. And in fact, this is being done, but not for the most important production mechanism of the top, namely the channel that is being looked at by the two main experiments, ATLAS and CMS, is the pair production of the top, where you have so many final state particles. It's so difficult to calculate predictions accurately, including loop corrections. But such analysis have been done, for example, for the total cross-section. So if you consider the total cross-section, it's inclusive, you integrate over the final state. And people have done that at the next-to-next-to leading order. In fact, my colleague Sven Moch in Hamburg is doing this analysis. And he analyzes the LHC data, and he can predict a short-distance mass, the MS bar mass. But the price to pay is that the uncertainty, the experimental uncertainty, is still very large. It's about 5 GV. Okay, so he has a very good, somehow theoretical approach, which was a well-defined mass parameter, but the outcome is, or the price to pay is still a large uncertainty.
So the real place to work here is in the event generators?
Yes, definitely, yes. To probably include all the next to leading order corrections. Yeah. It's a long-term project.
So you have to say it to us, yeah.
Thank you so much.